Hi everyone, welcome to the Idiots Podcast. That's Infectious Disease Insight of two specialists. I'm James, that's Callum. We're going to tell you everything you need to know about infectious disease.
Soon may the editing come to discontinue the Tazo Sun. One day when the CRP's done, we'll take our leave and go.
Callum, how are you doing? You getting used to recording, like, stare me in the eye?
Yeah, I can't just turn off my camera and ignore you.
No.
Anymore.
Wait, do you normally do that?
I've never done that.
Okay.
I never
fine.
Do that.
You never do it.
Well, I was just thinking, Jim, about how nice it is to be in your home.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you're at home, you're obviously the best version of yourself. Mm-hmm. You follow all the rules that you've laid out for other people.
Mm-hmm.
And you definitely don't just do your own thing and, you know, make things up as you go along.
Mm-hmm. Where are you going with this, Mudge?
Where am I going with this? Well, I think you know the topic of this show, and you know where I'm going with this.
Well, I brought it up. So this is another rant. Who knows when we'll put this in, probably when we've got a lull. But it is the following. Stewardship begins at home. And when I say begins at home, what I mean is infection doctors should be antimicrobial stewards first. Because there is nothing more frustrating to me, Callum, than an infection doctor turning round to me and saying something like, I don't trust this drug, or I quite like this drug, or why don't we just put them on meropenem or tazocin and then think about the diagnosis later.
Or even lower level than that, which is someone's on meropenem and we add in vancomycin, because they have to be vancomycin. They go together like a horse and carriage.
Yeah. What if it's MRSA?
Don't have MRSA. Their MRSA screen is negative. The clinical syndrome doesn't really fit with MRSA. Mm. Or
enterococcal
cover. And it's like, well, actually, probably meropenem maybe does cover let's not open that kind of worms.
Well, no. But I mean, if you gave that much of a crap about it, you would put them on an imipenem cilostatin.
Oh, I'm not really used to that. I don't like that.
I don't like that drug. I really hate that phrase. I don't like imipenem. I prefer meropenem.
Do you think that the issue is that because infection specialists know more about infection and antibiotics and spectra of activity and, you know, bacteria, is that we don't look at our own guidelines? Because I've been caught a cropper a couple of times. So there was a recent case where, you know, I think in my head, I looked at the guidelines for catheter-associated UTI a long time ago and used to recommend amoxicillin and gentamicin. And at some point, it changed to just being give a dose of gentamicin, change the catheter, and
yes, that's right.
Fine. Now, I didn't look at that guidance for a while because I advise a lot. And, you know, a bit of taste in my own medicine. I was talking to someone and I said something and they said, that's not what the guidelines say. Actually, today at work, it was hilarious. one of the consultants phoned pharmacy for advice about a tetanus vaccine. And the pharmacist said, have you looked at the antimicrobial guidelines? Because it's in there. And it was just like you obviously we hadn't looked there, so it was a bit embarrassing. But you know, it is.
Well, now I've realised, Callum, that you are part of the problem, because yeah. I'm the one that dropped amoxicillin from those guidelines.
I am part of the problem.
With my boss, my sort of mentor that I was doing the antimicrobial stewardship with when I was in NADOSH North, we'd sort of realised that, you know, when you look at what was causing counties, Enterococcus was this, you know, vanishing tiny number. I forget what it was, but it was certainly not enough to justify amoxicillin going in with every dosage.
Mm.
So we said, you know, what about just giving them gentamicin? You know, it's got staph cover, it's got gram-negative cover. You don't need to worry about anaerobes. Enterococcus, does it really matter, you know?
Yeah.
And I fought tooth and nail to get it stripped out, because I kind of like, why use two when you can use one? I just like simplicity. And eventually we put in some gumph about if they're at risk for enterococcal colonization, like as if they had an enterococcus infection in the past year or they've had recent, you know, intra-abdominal surgery, to add in amoxicillin, but yeah, otherwise to drop it. I thought to myself, none of our lot are going to look at that, because all of our lot thing that they know everything about antibiotics, you know?
Yeah, and, you know, there's a big part of infection management that is, you know, this is what we usually do. And that's a part of every part of life, isn't it? That sort of type 2 reasoning where it's just, you know, you get to a pattern recognition, you're like, okay, Cafdrosol's UTI equals amoxigen.
Yeah.
Without really examining why you need the amoxicillin or looking at the guidelines. And yeah, I think you're right that, you know, I've certainly had experiences where we've been on the infectious diseases ward, we're doing a ward round, and someone's got, you know, say a urinary tract infection, and the consultant gives a plan, which is, you know, let's give them some fosfomycin. Because they trust that, they've got experience with it, they know it's a good antibiotic, it's, you know, the pharmacokinetics is, you know, it's going to be great, right? But in our guidelines, we recommend using nitrofurantoin, and the patient had an organism and it was sensitive to nitrofurantoin, and that's our first line drug. And it took quite a lot of courage to speak up and say, why don't we use nitrofurantoin? That's first line in the guidelines. And they were sort of like, oh, you know, and I don't think it's not willful lack of, you know, we're not setting out and, you know, people sign up to be antibiotic stewards. So what is it that you see as the issue? Because I think that's, for me, as part of it is that we don't look at the guidelines, and so we go off piece a lot. And so we'll say, like, our guidelines for, you know, penallergic this might be vancomycin, and then we're all like, vancomycin's rubbish. So I'm going to use daptomycin instead. I'm going to use linezolid instead.
But that's not what I mean, because that, I would argue, is part of our job, where the guideline says one thing, and we realise that because we are looking at more up-to-date evidence,
shouldn't we change the guideline if it's a local guideline?
Systematic reviews and all that sort of stuff, that that's not the right drug for that patient. And so we then deviate from the guidance using our expertise. That's kind of what we're for. That's not what I mean. What I mean is when infection specialists have developed a predilection for using some antimicrobials over others, and then continue to do so, despite the fact that new evidence has come out stating that that's not a good idea. So, case in point.
James got a consultant appointment, and now he's really letting you lose.
Yeah, now I've got a job locked down, I'm off the bloody chain, okay? Nobody's safe. Nados north, Nados south, I'm coming for you both. Nah, it's not like that. But, like, it's just, like, say the recent IDSA guidance. So I've just taught the local registrars on this. The IDSA guidance is for AMP-C in particular. And I know this is just about to be updated, if it hasn't already. It will have been by the time this has come out. It's going to be updated in the next month. And those two documents are going to be amalgamated into one. But for AMP-C, it says, so for Citrobacter frundii, Enterobacter coli, and Klebsiella aerogenes, it says, you know, basically based on the result of the Merino trial, don't trust, you know, stuff like PIPTAS, we recommend a carbapenem. And those are the high probability AMP-C producers. So their risk of producing AMP-C,
chromosomal
AMP-C, is between 8 and 40%. And so that's your high risk AMP-C. So they're your HEC ES organisms, them and a couple of others.
So we've talked about it before. That's organisms that, because obviously, like, if someone is producing, expressing AMP-C, or has got it on a plasmid or something, then it will come up in reports and you recognize a pattern. You'd be colpoxin resistant, colmoxiclav resistant, you know.
Yeah, but even if you don't see that on the antibiogram, that's the IDSA are saying it doesn't matter.
Because I think anybody that you them. Like in the lab results, you think, or if you have to do a test for AMP-C even. If you see that, then you wouldn't use PIPTAS because you're like, oh, that looks like an AMP-C, I'm not going to use it. But these organisms, even if it looks sensitive, they're saying don't use them.
Yes. But for non those three organisms, they're saying that you should just prescribe antibiotics according to the antibiogram that you have in front of you because they're lower risk. So low risk they define as like less than 5%. So that would be things like, you know, serratia, and
yes, the recent marcescens,
stuff that was in the old nomenclature.
Yeah, like what was the old or scapum?
Escapum organisms.
Morganella morgani was in there.
Yeah, so they're all much lower risk. Protein, so the IDSA have taken that evidence that there's actually high risk AMP-C producers and low risk AMP-C producers, chromosomal AMP-C, and said, okay, you don't need to treat these the same. And they've done that based on some pretty good epidemiological data.
Yeah.
But I have had consultants turn around and say to me, I just don't trust that data, so I'm going to give a carbapen to everyone. That's what I mean, Callum.
Yeah.
And that's infuriating, because if you're going to look at the evidence base and say, this evidence base, which may have its flaws, but may actually be pretty good data, I'm going to ignore it and go with the dogma of yesteryear just because I'm used to it. That's what I mean, stewardship should start.
Yeah, no, yeah, that's...
And the stuff that you and me are interested in, you know, your penicillin allergy, the labelling, you know, to give another example. How many times have you run into roadblocks where people don't trust the data that you're presenting?
We've talked about this before. What was that episode?
Where we were talking about...
I think it was the penicillin allergy episode 13 or whatever. But, you know, how many times was that somebody in the core team or a nurse or somebody like that? No, it was other infection doctors who didn't trust it. People who wanted to ignore that information and keep on going with what they were doing.
We are a specialty or a group of specialties, I guess, that for a long time has had a dearth of data. And so it has been acceptable to rely on dogma because it's not been nothing better. And everybody's doing this.
Yeah.
Nobody's maliciously setting out to do the wrong thing for the patients. Everyone believes, I believe, that they're doing the right thing. Like, people are turning up to work to do the best thing that they can. And people are saying this based on their training and the practices they've come up with, which has been dogmatic, based on opinion, expert opinion. But yeah, I think the real sin here is that we, as humans, when we make decisions, weigh, you know, it's like that thing with the biases that you look for evidence that supports your existing beliefs, yeah, isn't it? Yeah. That's human nature. There's nothing like, you know, you need to be aware of that. And when people challenge you, accepting and willing to change your practice based on updated evidence. And that is the issue when someone is presented with data. And it's not just like, here's a paper at Journal Club. It's, this is, you know, if not the biggest, one of the biggest infection societies in the world who have gone through all the data, who have, you know, carefully considered it and come up with, I don't know what the strength of the recommendation is. Do they give strengths of recommendation?
Yeah, they did. But I didn't memorize the, you know, strength of recommendations. But, you know, that's a world-renowned infection organization, probably the biggest one that we've got, that has recommended this kind of course of action. And, you know, I'm sitting in front of consultants that are just saying, I just, don't want to do that. And because they're consultants, that's what happens. But now I'm the consultant, Callum. So that's my first example of, you know, antimicrobial stewardship begins at home. Do you have one?
So many examples, but, and some of those examples could be me, I think.
I think a bunch of them are me, earlier versions of me, but yeah.
Yeah, now you're perfect. But and I still struggle with this. Yeah, I think diagnostic stewardship is another way of looking at this.
Mm.
So, you know, making sure that we only send the tests that are strictly necessary that will change patient management. And we sometimes talk about tests being academic. You know, that's an academic test. And in our pursuit of diagnosis, which I think is the right thing to do, and I think that's what we do in our specialty well often, is say, be the people saying, okay, but what's the diagnosis? You know, pushing for diagnostic tests, pushing for tissue, pushing for interventions, pushing for, you know, trying to actually figure out what's wrong, because then we can predict other things, rather than just saying, like, we don't know where the sepsis is, but they're on antibiotics, are getting better, and that's good enough.
Mm.
But maybe sometimes that is good enough, and maybe sometimes we do push too hard, or we do tests that aren't maybe going to change that much.
So have you heard of the Choosing Wisely campaign?
I have heard of Choosing
Wisely. It's going on in America, and it's sort of like emergency medicine and sort of front door focus, but it's things like, you know, don't order CTPA in people with a negative D-dimer. You know, like stuff like that. And, you know, it was like 6 recommendations of stuff not to do in circumstances. And they were all pretty kind of low-hanging fruit. And I don't know what's happened to the campaign more recently, but, you know, we, as infection specialists, I think we're biased towards looking for stuff to an extent that's maybe not true in other medical specialties, just because the infections can be anywhere, so the tests that we employ have to be quite broad.
I imagine if we ask this question of other specialties, you'd have lots of examples like, oh, you know, infection, they're always coming along and saying, do a bowel on this patient in ICU for a lower respiratory tract infection, but we don't need to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And that balance between getting a diagnosis when you really need to, and sometimes just accepting that you don't have one, that balance of getting the deep samples, but if the patient's getting better on your antibiotics, do you really want to put them through an invasive test that might mean that, you put them at risk? Is that definitely beneficial? And also just like the way in which we all approach serological tests, you know, people that are trying to retrap. I guess, to come to what might be the solution is that I think the SMI is quite good at this. The standards for microbiological investigations. Mm-hmm. They lay out, like in the flow charts at the end of each of them, they lay out like what's your routine tests and what to do in addition in certain circumstances. And also thinking about tests. So, you know, say you've got someone presenting with a syndrome like respiratory tract infection, you know, grading it by lots of things. So severity can be quite useful. So if they've got a non-severe pneumonia, you're not really recommended to do sputum. Whereas I think often we would say, like, send sputum, send blood cultures, send
PCR. So NADOS South, they've got this a sort of tag that goes at the end of all sputum samples that says, outside of, you know, TB, testing for sputum is low yield or something. I forget the way that they phrase it. You know, when I came down from NADOS North, I thought that was a really kind of odd thing. And I'd not seen it before. But then if you look at the NICE guidance for pneumonia, it sort of says that, you know, if it's a non-severe pneumonia, that there's probably not
much point. Yeah, the main thing you want really is to test for Legionella, isn't it?
But, and yet, even there, that's a can of worms, isn't it? Because down here, they're still using the Legionella antigen, whereas...
We're still using it up north as well.
Well, but restricted, and you need permission from Micro to do it, and they'd much rather that you did a sputum PCR for Legionella.
Yeah, send more blood cultures, send more tests and cultures.
Mm.
Sometimes I catch myself trying to say, you know, the patient's on broad spectrum antimicrobials, or they've got urinary tract infection, and then we'll send another culture. Or they've got slightly loose stools, and we say, send a C. diff test. Yeah, well, they're not diarrhea, like it's only like two bowel motions a day, or they're on meropenem IV. Like, how likely is a blood culture actually going to be positive here? Very, very low. They've already had three sets and they're all negative. Like, why are we still doing this?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I think that's a good aspect of antimicrobial and stewardship in general for any specialty. And I think you're right that in terms of closer to home, that we maybe do have a tendency to over-investigate and over-test and try and really find that diagnosis, because I guess it's maybe one of the reasons is that we are biased in our case mix. So we see the more complicated people. We see the intra-abdominal infection, which didn't have pus sent and then they got a complication. But we don't see all the other patients that the surgeons are seeing with appendectomies and completely uncomplicated, and they don't send pus and there's no problems.
True.
Yeah, so Jim, we're sitting in your home, and you said that antimicrobial stewardship begins at home. So what do you think your takeaway or your message to the loyal listener would be about getting antimicrobial stewardship right as an infection specialist?
I think that if you are a sort of early to mid or even late stage trainee, and you read something that's, you know, made it to guideline level, and you know that it's not being implemented in your trust, I think that that would be a reason to speak up and ask, like, why are we not doing this? You know, why are we not, you know, implementing the IDSA difficult to treat gram-negative guidance? Why are we not using kefideracol instead of colistin for carbapenem-resistant Acinetobacter baumannii? That kind of stuff where the trials have come out and the evidence is, you know, clearly in the favor of something else. Are you just using or just doing an old work pattern because that's what everybody's used to? Like, have people just not kept up to date with the data? Or is there a desire to continue to use an existing dogma? And when it is an existing dogma, I think we should challenge that.
Yeah.
Like, you and me have taken quite big steps in challenging penicillin allergy delabeling dogmas in NAIDOSH North. And I think that it's been,
team I've been a small part of.
Well, we both have.
Yeah.
We both have. But, like, it's been a bit of us, a bit of our training that we've really taken on. And I can't think of a downside, you know, to doing that, given the state of the evidence base.
Yeah. If we're talking about home, I think my idea there would be that, and this speaks to me because I've certainly postgraduately really just practiced in the same centre for like 10 years. And you get used to the dogma and you accept the dogma of that area. So if you're wanting to look at what good antimicrobial stewardship at home looks like, go to your friend's house and see what they do there. Because if you visit a different health board, centre, hospital, country, or you go to a conference and you go to a talk and you hear what other people are doing, or you just read their guidelines, I think it's really eye-opening to be like, oh, this thing that we do, that we are so committed to and believe in so strongly and really go out there and advocate for, someone else who is a competent person is trying to do the best for their patient is saying something completely different.
Yeah,
and they're doing it different.
Yeah,
and then you're like, they're not stupid. So why are they doing that? And why are we not doing that? And if the guidelines say it, and someone, you know, there's evidence out there and there's not evidence for the way we do it, maybe your friend's house is better and you should steal their stuff.
All right, I'm going to go and strap everything down. See you later, Cal.
Thanks for this whiskey.
Went off the rails there.
Thank you for listening to the Idiots Podcast, the UK's premier infectious disease podcast. We are supported by the British Infection Association, but they do not have creative control over the episode content, so please don't blame them if we get something wrong.
Questions, comments, suggestions? Why don't you send them in to idiotspodcasting@gmail.com? Have a 5-star review in your pocket? Calm and I would love to have it. Please drop it in your podcast player of choice. We tweet at @idiots_pod. And if you want to donate to support the show, there's a link to do so in the description. But until next time, I'm James.
I'm Callum.
See you then.
Now that the episode's done, we hope you learned and had lots of fun. So go forth and treat people with some of what you now know.